Try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait. Will this send me spiraling out of my routine?
Time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your metabolism. Drink butter coffee instead to kill cravings.
What? Is it really that bad? I had protein this morning, right? Ugh, but it looks so good.
Only eat after walking 10,000 steps.
Pie is only 2 steps from here. Am I overthinking again?
Fruit ruins
Never
insulin
Never eat after 7 p.m.
One cheat day.
Cut carbs by
30 Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. No fads, no fear. Just your signal. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. That's SIGNOS.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Save big money on your bathroom update at Menards. Transform your bathroom with a stunning new vanity from Magic Woods. With over 100 options to choose from, our vanities combine contemporary style with durable materials. Find the ideal piece to create the bathroom you've always wanted. From stylish and elegant to simple and modern, save big money on Magic Woods vanities at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all our great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series. Or if you're new here, welcome. Thank you for choosing to spend the next half an hour or so learning about this case today. I pretty much solely cover cold cases on my platforms. I talk about missing people, unidentified people, murder cases that have gone unsolved. Cases just need extra eyes on them in order to cross the finish line and finally get answers. You never know when one person will unknowingly or maybe knowingly hold the key to unlock a whole case. Sometimes that person just needs to be reached. Today, the unsolved case in question is that of Sheila Jean Collins, an 18-year-old student who disappeared from Iowa State University on the 26th of January 1968. Sheila's body would be found 2 days later in a gravel ditch, and to this day, the person responsible for her murder has never been found. But let's start by learning a bit about Sheila, about who she was. And this is one of those old cold cases where digging for information was a bit of a struggle because there's not loads out there about her this many decades on. But what I could find was from a podcast called Greenlee Investigates the Murder of Sheila Jean Collins. Now, this is a 5-part podcast by a number of student journalists at Iowa State University who are just trying to raise awareness of Sheila's case whilst also putting their investigative and storytelling techniques they've learned at university to practical use. Episode 2 of the podcast includes an interview with a man called Randy Calm, who was one of Sheila's childhood friends and neighbours, and he described her as a really nice girl and kind of a goofball. But by the time she'd gone to university, the pair had kind of drifted apart. People who knew Sheila at the time of her murder describe her as the quiet, studious type. She tended to stay away from trouble. She didn't like confrontation and she was well liked. Her house mother in her dorms at the time said that she didn't have any quarrels with anybody. Sheila was born on the 2nd of August 1949 to her parents James and Muriel Collins in Elmhurst, Illinois, and she was the oldest of 3 daughters. But not long after she was born, the family actually moved to Evanston. She eventually attended Evanston Township High School, where she graduated in June 1967 and headed off to Iowa State University to study English and speech. At Iowa State, which was in the city of Ames in, obviously, Iowa, Sheila lived the standard university lifestyle for the time. She made friends, she studied, but the people who knew her said she was never really into the sort of the drinking and drug culture of student life. And of course, this was the 1960s, so student life back then was very different than it is now. Sheila and her classmates didn't have smartphones at the tip of their fingers, they didn't even have the internet. Things weren't really instant back then like they are nowadays, and if you wanted to communicate with others, if you wanted to join a club, find friends, advertise a party, or even get a lift someplace, it was very commonplace to leave a leaflet pinned to the wall in the common areas. At the Memorial Student Union, there was a board called the Going My Way board, in which students would basically write on index cards asking if people were driving in the direction that they wanted to go in so they could share lifts. This was the 1960s, Uber didn't exist. On the board was this map divided into all these different numbered zones with similar numbered slots for each zone beneath the map. A student who was looking for a lift would fill out a green card, whereas if you were offering a ride, you'd fill out a pink card. At some point, Sheila had filled out one of those green cards, requesting a ride to DeKalb, Illinois, or just the Chicago area on any Friday. It doesn't look like Sheila had her own car at university with her, so in order to get home to Evanston, which was just outside Chicago, she generally had to find another student who was driving in that direction and hitch a ride with them. This was something all the students did. Ironically, this is actually a system put in place to keep students safer than it would be for them to just go out and hitchhike with random people outside of campus. The idea was students have other students' backs. On the weekend Sheila died, she had big plans to go back to Chicago and see her boyfriend and see her family. And her boyfriend Ira was actually originally supposed to come and pick her up on that Friday, and they were going to spend a couple of days together. However, this plan didn't work out and Ira wasn't going to be able to come and pick her up. We don't know the reason for this, but sometimes plans just don't work out. Plans have to change a bit. Now, from the ride request card, it actually seems like Sheila wasn't looking for a ride back home to Evanston. Instead, she was wanting a ride directly to DeKalb, Illinois, where the Des Moines Register reported that Ira went to Northern Illinois University. Or she wrote she just wanted to get to the general Chicago area. You might assume that Sheila intended to go straight to DeKalb to meet Ira, but as you'll come to see, she later called her parents and told them that she was coming home to them in Evanston. This is a discrepancy I was never quite able to get straight. I don't think there's anything like nefarious behind that. Maybe Sheila just changed her plans last minute. Ira and Sheila had a long distance relationship. They attended these different universities, but they were high school sweethearts and they seemed determined to keep their relationship going, with some rumours even saying that they weren't far off an engagement. They wrote each other love letters all the time and made the effort to go back to Evanston to see each other whenever they could. The distance was undeniably rough, with a letter found in Sheila's belongings from Ira saying, "Needless to say, things would be different if you were nearer me. That could be the reason why I don't write that much. I do miss you and I do love you." So it seems there might have been some communication over Ira not writing as much as maybe Sheila would have liked, but it was difficult. They were teenagers, they're at university, they were sort of navigating these new adult lives together. As I said, they made the effort to see each other when they could, and Ira not being able to come and pick up Sheila that day didn't deter her from getting back to Chicago. She decided to put up the index card on the Going My Way board to see if somebody else was leaving Ames headed in that direction. I am slightly confused by the fact that under sort of the date leaving part of the card, Sheila had written any Friday to go back home, not specifically this Friday in question, but maybe she'd made peace that she wasn't going to be able to make it back that weekend and so instead took her luck with any Friday. Or maybe this was a card that she left there permanently, so anyone ever travelling back in that direction on a Friday could give her a lift. It was an easy way for her to get home. Maybe she thought she just got lucky on that Friday night when Ira cancelled. She thought it was fate that she was going to be able to go back and see him. Around 7:30 p.m. on the 26th of January 1968, Sheila received a phone call from presumably another student offering her a ride, asking her if she could be ready in 15 minutes. She was honest, said that was going to be a rush, and asked for half an hour instead, and the person on the other end agreed. So she rushed back to her dorm room at Elm Hall to pack her suitcase. According to an article in Iowa State Daily by Kylie Horter, she borrowed $2 in travel money from one of her friends, threw on a sweatshirt, and gave her parents a quick call to let them know she was on her way home to Evanston. Perhaps her and Ira had changed plans and decided to go back to Evanston that night instead. Perhaps she thought she'd spend the night with her parents before heading to DeKalb to see him. Perhaps that was never the plan. I don't really know. All I know is Sheila called her parents and said that she was going to be coming home. Sheila apparently also told one of her roommates that the man on the other end of the phone had told her his name, but she didn't remember it. But she didn't seem to mind that too much. She was just really excited to have a lift back home. But she did ask her roommates to walk her to the intersection of Lincoln Way and Beach Avenue, where the caller had said they would pick her up. For whatever reasons, all her roommates declined to do so, and so Sheila walked there on her own. It was only 5 minutes away. The last time Sheila was seen alive was around 8:30 p.m, seen standing near the busy intersection waiting for her lift. Other sources say that some other witnesses saw her getting into a dark blue Volkswagen, with the driver being a conventional looking young white man, and it seems composite sketches were made of this man. But Sheila would never make it back home to her parents. Her parents waited up all night for her to make it back home, but of course she never arrived at their front door. By noon the next day, they reported her as missing to the police. I couldn't find any information as to what happened in the hours after Sheila was reported missing. I don't know if police brushed off as a runaway, or if they took it seriously, or if they just told her parents to wait. But it turns out they didn't need to wait long at all. At around 2 p.m. on the Sunday, so sort of coming up now to 48 hours since Sheila was seen at the intersection, a doctor, Roger Hogle, and his son Jeff were out hunting in some land 5 miles east of the city of Nevada, when his son was exploring the ditches along the side of a gravel road, as 8-year-old boys tend to do.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches, but there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
According to the Greenlee Investigates podcast, which actually interviewed Roger, Jeff shouted, "Dad, Dad, I see a kid's foot." Turns out that Jeff had come across the body of a petite girl, 5'1", with long straight brown hair. Sheila. Of course, Roger didn't know who this was at the time. He just got straight in his car, drove into Nevada to the courthouse to report the body to the sheriff. And then he headed back to the road to block it off and prevent anyone else coming along and messing with the crime scene until law enforcement eventually got there. Roger said this was a very quiet and isolated place. There were no houses along this road at all. There would have been nobody around for miles to witness the murder. Investigators would later say that this is what made them pretty certain that the perpetrator here was a local. This was somebody who knew the area, knew how isolated this road was. The area in which Sheila was found was only around 15 miles, about a 20-ish minute drive from the intersection where she'd last been seen. The question has always been whether this person responsible was indeed a student who knew the area well, or whether it was a random person, a local, who wandered into the union, picked a random index card off the board, which happened to be that of Sheila's, and called her. Or was the perpetrator not the person who'd called her at all, instead being a random person who saw a beautiful young girl waiting on the side of the road with a suitcase, assumed she was waiting for a lift, and took their chance? Although we can assume that the caller and the murderer are the same person, that's what makes most sense, we don't know that for sure. What we do know is the caller never came forward. Sheila's body was found face down in the gravel ditch, her body kind of positioned as if she'd been posed on her hands and knees with her coat draped over her body, pretty much obscuring it from view. It was pure luck that she was seen as quickly as she was. She was partially naked, her sweatshirt or t-shirt pulled up around her neck, and according to an article from the Des Moines Register from the day after her body was found, the rest of her clothes, so her underwear and blue jeans, were found in a field just west of where she'd been found, as if they'd been sort of placed or gently thrown over the fence. Alongside her clothes was also her purse and a suitcase containing a Polaroid camera, her sociology textbook, and a green dress. Her purse still had money in it, so robbery clearly wasn't the motive here. According to Molly Blanco for iowastatedaily.com, the suitcase still remained at the Story County Sheriff's Office to this very day. Although a connection was made pretty quickly between this unidentified girl and the missing persons report Sheila's parents had made, an official identification wasn't made until her father was able to travel to the Stevens funeral home in Ames to confirm it was her. And of course, it was. In the immediate aftermath of the discovery, one official spoke to the press and said that he had no doubt that this was a sex crime and that Sheila had been sexually molested or assaulted. It was also presumed from very early on that her cause of death was strangulation due to a nylon rope that was found strung around her neck and tangled in her hair. And that was something that was confirmed when the medical examiner's report eventually came through. But then, in a bit of a plot twist, the medical examiner, Dr. William Bliss, said publicly that this was a very strange case because there was actually nothing to indicate any sexual molestation or rape, no evidence of assault in any way. Usually in cases of this kind, there's some evidence of torture or brutality, but they found nothing. There wasn't a mark on her. He also said that he didn't know whether she'd been undressed before or after her death, but due to the whole scene, he did surmise at least that the perpetrator had a sexual deviation of some kind. Apparently back in the late 1960s, if there was no obvious evidence of any rape, it didn't really happen, so all the newspaper articles at the time say that she wasn't sexually assaulted. Today we know that many sexual assaults don't leave a physical record on the body, so she may well have been assaulted in some description. What they did say at the time was this death was sexually motivated in some form. She'd been stripped naked, posed on her hands and knees, but they didn't know if she'd actually been, like, touched. As suspected, her cause of death did seem to be the small nylon rope that we knotted around her neck, with Dr. Bliss saying that a pipe incorporated in the knot had been used as a turning mechanism to sort of tighten the rope around her neck and strangle her. I know there's an actual name for that and it's on the tip of my tongue and I haven't been able to find it despite extensively googling. If anyone knows the name for sort of when you use something to tighten a knot or a rope or something, please put me out of my misery because it's been driving me mad for a couple of weeks now. What this cause of death suggests was that this doesn't seem to be a sort of moment of madness kind of act. This does seem to be more planned out. The person who picked up Sheila that day did so with the intent of killing her. They didn't just have a nylon rope at hand, but they also knew how to use a mechanism to tighten the rope and ensure her death. Rumour has it that the Storey County Sheriff's Office have since misplaced this nylon rope. Now, in terms of how long Sheila had been dead, the Des Moines Register wrote, "The death took place sometime within 24 hours after she was last seen here about 8:30 p.m. Friday." And although that seems like a very confusing way to word that sentence, I think it means that she was murdered within 24 hours of when she was last seen, and not in the 24 hours before she was found, I think. It was also suspected that Sheila hadn't died in the spot where she was found. She was very likely killed elsewhere, maybe somewhere warm, and then her body was placed in the ditch. Although I did take the information from a Des Moines Register article from the day after she was found, so before the medical examiner had released any reports, so do take that with a pinch of salt. In terms of forensic evidence, there's really not much here. I mean, this was 1968 and they had no idea about DNA evidence or anything like that. So any evidence at the scene wouldn't have been stored according to our standards today. That makes it pretty useless when it comes to any kind of DNA testing. But apparently there is still hope. They have been able to find a tiny sample of DNA collected from the crime scene. And up to this point, DNA analysis hasn't been particularly helpful here. According to Anthony Rode, the current investigation sergeant for the Storey County Sheriff's Office speaking to Iowa State Daily, they've got two people's DNA here. They've got one female and one male, but the chain is so broken and so mixed up that they haven't been able to put together any kind of profile yet. We can probably assume that the female DNA might be Sheila's, although it didn't say that, so we don't know for sure. The male DNA may well be the person responsible. As well as this, they also found some enlarged footprints near the fence over which Sheila's belongings had been dumped. These footprints were described as, you know, the kind that are made in the snow. I'm not sure what they're trying to get at with this. I don't think it was actually snowing where Sheila was found because no other source makes any reference to snow of any kind. Maybe the footprints were just in the mud, but not perfect, you know? Like, you kind of know when you're walking in the snow with your step, the footprint widens and kind of distorts. That might be what they're talking about here. And that's about all they've got. And whilst investigators could be excused for the DNA here, they didn't exactly do great with this investigation as a whole. There were no fingernail scrapings taken from Sheila, which was standard practice for a medical examiner to do in this time. That could have been a smoking gun nowadays with DNA testing. She might have fought back and got sort of DNA under her nails. It didn't happen. The rideshare card on the board at the Union was also never dusted for fingerprints. You could assume that the caller would have picked up her card to take note of the number at the very least. but we'll never know now. And her body was also buried within just a number of days of her death in accordance with Jewish laws, meaning there was no chance of more evidence being collected. Her funeral was held on Wednesday, January 31st in her hometown. The day before her funeral though, so the Tuesday after her discovery, a press conference was held at the City Council Chambers where Story County Attorney Charles E. Vandenberg said that the investigation had no suspects. He said, "We have no big break. I doubt very much if we will release the medical examiner's report or any material contained within it." And whilst we do have what the medical examiner and investigators have said publicly, I wasn't actually able to find if this report was ever released. I don't know if it was, I couldn't find it anyway. Vandenberg also said they had 15 officers working on this case, including several from the State Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and they'd asked for help from the FBI as well. A follow-up article from the next day says that the FBI actually declined to help as they had no authority to investigate a local crime, but they did make their labs and facilities available if they wished to use them. However, the FBI did eventually respond to a request for input though, and they made a profile of the killer here, and it was pretty awful looking back on it now. So FBI agent Walter McLaughlin wrote that Sheila didn't appear to be an attractive girl, which is actually really crazy to me because from the photos we have of her, Sheila was undeniably a gorgeous young girl. But apparently Walter said because she wasn't attractive, there was no reason why a man would be infatuated with her or have any great desire towards her. Therefore, she had to be a victim of circumstance. She was just a victim here because her card was there. Maybe that was the case, but it seems like a very mean way to put forward such an opinion. This profile was also quite racist. It was the 1960s. McLaughlin said that he assumed the killer was a young white man because black men do not go in for this fancy dance stuff. They ordinarily rape accompanied by brutality, but they do not use sadistic refinements such as a pipe and nylon cord. I mean, it's just absolutely unbelievable to hear something like that now. I'd like to think you wouldn't hear something like that now, but this was a professional investigator back in the 1960s. And despite this, and the fact that witnesses say they saw Sheila get into the car with a white man, of course, many people of colour were dragged in for questioning. But going back to the topic of Charles Vandenberg for a second, the county attorney who held this press conference, he did seem to have the best interests at heart at the beginning of this investigation, I'll give him that. Maybe he thought he could solve it and it would look great to the public, but things did soon flip once he realised that this case wasn't getting solved. Vandenberg was actually running for Iowa's Attorney General for the GOP at this time, so he had a lot of political motivations behind his handling of Sheila's case. When it kind of became clear that this wasn't going to be an easy solve, he would eventually suggest that Sheila was a student radical and she had a drug problem that might have been the motivation behind her death. I mean, he even got federal narcotics agents involved in this case, which obviously got the media talking. Of course, Sheila didn't even drink, let alone do drugs, but one of Vandenberg's main political platforms was anti-drug. He was trying to sort out the apparent drug problem in Ames. He used Sheila's death to push his own political agenda, and there's no way of knowing how much this distraction, this sort of misinformation, affected the investigation. To this day, lots of people in the Ames area hear Sheila's name and think that she's the drug girl who died, that she brought her death upon herself. Which in any situation would be very victim-blamey, but it's not even true here. Sheila didn't do drugs. The public perception of this case was entirely derailed. With the disappearance and murder of Sheila, students at Iowa State were very shaken, particularly the female students. At this point in their life, at this time, they hadn't had to take much notice of personal safety. Nothing like this ever happened around them. It never happened at Iowa State. Up until this point, there were students, teenagers, in a bubble, happily jumping into cars with other students who offered them lifts. Whereas before they always felt very safe, being alone, being independent, now they became scared. Everyone on campus became a possible suspect and all the trust was gone. And actually, whilst we're on the topic of suspects here kind of, I do want to take a moment to talk about Ira. So being Sheila's boyfriend who had cancelled on giving her a lift, suspicion was immediately cast upon him. In those early days, Ira was questioned by officers, but he wasn't necessarily a suspect, with it later being found that he had an ironclad alibi. According to historian Nancy Bowers, who spoke to the Greenlee Investigates podcast, Ira and Sheila had phone calls all the time, and the phone records show that they're actually on the phone as late as 7 p.m. that night, so just an hour and a half before Sheila was last seen. And obviously, this would have been a landline phone in a time before mobile. So with Ira in Illinois talking on his landline and Sheila in Iowa, there's just no way he could have travelled all the way there in time to pick her up, and then for some unknown reason attack and kill her. Plus, if it was Ira picking Sheila up, her roommates would have known about it. She was so excited to go home just to see him. But just to double down on all this, Ira did also do a polygraph test which confirmed his innocence once and for all. So Ira, categorically not a suspect. Soon, the Iowa State Daily, the student newspaper, was offering a reward of $410 for any information leading to the apprehension of the killer, which is equivalent to about $3,500 today, a pretty decent reward. However, Robert Blair, the head of the State Bureau of Criminal Investigation, said around this same time that an early break should not be expected in this case. When you have crime in a large metropolitan area, it's tough. Sometimes it's several years before a case is solved, he said. I don't think anyone expected, though, that this case would still be unsolved in 2023. Within months, Charles Vandenberg would say that 30 separate law enforcement agencies had spent more than 2,500 hours on this case, with the investigation going as far as California, where people had been questioned. Eventually, the investigation team on this narrowed down to just 5 people full time. You had 2 from the Iowa Bureau of Criminal Investigation, 2 Ames policemen, and 1 Story County deputy. He also said there have been 712 personal interviews in this case so far, with about 200 more people they wanted to see. More than 100 leads from telephone tips have been checked out, plus another 100 leads from their own investigation. Vandenberg said they had managed to eliminate a lot of people as suspects in this case, which he described as negative progress, and said that most theories, bar sort of accident and suicide, were very open. He also said that it would remain possible that a woman was possible for Sheila's death. However, by the 4th of July 1968, so just months after Sheila's body had been found, the then Story County Sheriff J.I. Shalley announced the Sheriff's Office were no longer actively investigating Sheila's murder. For many years, this case went completely cold, completely untouched, uninvestigated. At least that was until 2009, when the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation established a cold case unit, and Sheila's murder was one of 150 on the list, hoping that it could finally be solved through advancements in DNA technology. Federal funding for this cold case unit, though, ran out just 2 years later, but apparently they remain committed to resolving Iowa's cold cases. But all of this is not to say that over the years they didn't come to form a suspect list. In fact, they had lots of potential suspects in this case, just no solid evidence against any of them. I really try not to focus on suspects on my platform. I think getting the facts out there is much more important than speculation, and I've come to realise that if I'm sharing a list of 5 suspects, 4 of them are completely innocent, and it's just not the most helpful practice. However, I will talk about a couple of very interesting men in this case, identifying them by their first names only. So there was a man called Arthur who was brought in June 1968. He was caught calling women who had left their phone numbers on the ride-sharing board, so instantly the connection was made to Sheila's murder. He was given a polygraph test and showed signs of deception. Apparently he used a fake name when calling these women, which again is just very suspicious. There had been lots of reports to men or a man doing this to women on campus, and Arthur eventually admitted to calling more than 30 female students using a fake identity, trying to convince them to meet him on campus at night, and the reports say he was very sexually aggressive. Arthur was a graduate student at Iowa State at this point. He lived near campus, not on campus. He had a wife and young child, and at the time of Sheila's disappearance, he was driving a borrowed blue Volkswagen. Just a number of days later, he bought a new car. Reports say that he was an average height man with short brown hair, very much matching the conventional description of the man that Sheila may have got into the car with. When investigators looked in the trunk of his new car, which was a yellow Mustang, they found a rope that matched the nylon cord used to strangle Sheila. Coincidence or not, you decide. And he couldn't explain why this nylon rope was in his possession, of course. A year later, a woman, a real estate agent called Dorothy Miller, would be found murdered in Burlington, Iowa, by a young man who asked her to show him a house at night. She would then be attacked, tied up, raped and stabbed, and Dorothy was found in a very similar state of undress as Sheila had been. The killer, of course, had used a fake name for the booking with Dorothy, but he said he was from Des Moines, which is where Arthur had moved to. He also said he was married with a young child, and Dorothy's husband, who had seen the killer, described him as very similar in looks to Arthur, and therefore similar to the man that Sheila had got in the car with. But Arthur had a spotless criminal record, and he passed the part of the polygraph test when he was asked about Sheila's death. They had nothing at all to link him to the crime, bar a resemblance, the same car, and a bit of nylon rope. It was all circumstantial, not exactly an airtight criminal case. It really could have been a coincidence. The other suspect I want to mention today is a man called Bernard. He was a graduate student lab technician at Iowa State, and he was known to be a man with a very difficult personality. He was highly sexed and easily angered, as well as having a very controlling streak. He'd joined the army in 1960, but was dishonourably discharged for being AWOL and unfit. Generally, he just didn't seem to be a great man, and by his own admission, he was a chronic compulsive liar, and the investigators described him as creepy. Bernard came to their attention when one of his co-workers actually sent in an anonymous note about him, because he gave them the creeps, and he drove a blue Volkswagen. He also turned up to work after Sheila's murder with scratches all over his face. However, he does have a kind of alibi for that night. Apparently on the night that Sheila disappeared, Bernard called his then wife saying he had a flat tyre and he wasn't going to be able to pick her up from work as they'd originally planned. He described away the scratches by saying he'd fallen whilst trying to fix said tyre, during which time he also lost his glasses. That all sounds like a big excuse as to why he was home late, why he was covered in scratches. He could have been attacking Sheila instead. However, the timeline here is questionable. Let's say that he had picked up Sheila at the intersection at 8:30 p.m. He would have had to have driven 15 miles, so sort of 20-ish minutes away, to kill Sheila and dispose of her body and belongings. And this is discarding of the fact that she may have been killed somewhere else entirely. Then he had to drive 21 miles back to Northwest Ames to flatten his tyre and call his wife all by 10 p.m. That gives him an hour and a half at the absolute maximum to do all of this. Also, as I said, he lost his glasses at some point, and the theory is that he may have lost them in the fight with Sheila, but nothing was found at the crime scene, and his wife said that he had incredibly bad eyesight. There is no way that he would have been able to drive all the way back to Ames without wearing his glasses. He would have got in a crash, like his eyesight was terrible. In October 1968, he was subject to a polygraph test, but no deception at all was found, and up until that point, he had no criminal history. However, that would change the next year. In 1969, he was arrested for prowling, although he was found not guilty. 2 years later, he was arrested for contributing to the delinquency of a minor by taking photos of underage girls. He received a 3-year suspended prison sentence for that one. In 1973, he was arrested for accosting and annoying. In 1976, he was arrested for lewd, lascivious and immoral acts to a child, a charge which would be dropped or reduced. And then over in Tennessee, police also had a warrant out for his arrest after he was accused of stealing $30,000 as well as a lot of technical equipment. This warrant would never be served because in 1977, he fled the country, going to Israel with a stolen identity. He would also be caught stealing in Israel though, so he had to flee again, and he's never been heard from since.
Want to try a free sample?
Oh yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body, only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK, Cygnos.
So there's no denying that this Bernard was a creepy and dangerous guy with a proclivity towards young girls, underage girls. But was he capable of murder? Well, he didn't match the descriptions of the potential killer, nor did his wife ever recall him owning a blue Volkswagen. So where does all of this leave us with Sheila's case today? Well, I kind of suppose this entire case currently hinges on that small sample of DNA. They just need to get that DNA to a lab that could potentially help put the DNA back together, and that absolutely can be done. I wonder if the Sheriff's Office have contacted Othram or any other similar labs to help them put the genetic profile back together, and maybe through genealogy we may be able to get an answer here. However, finding the person who this DNA belongs to doesn't automatically make them the killer. This evidence wasn't stored as according to regulations today. This DNA could have come from after the fact, it could have come from somebody Sheila spoke to or had contact with that day. As the public, we don't actually know how damning this evidence is. We don't know where on the body or at the crime scene it was found. If investigators are focusing in on this though, maybe that does suggest it might be damning. I might actually contact the Sheriff's Office myself if I'm brave enough and see if they have sent this DNA to a private lab or see if they need funding for such a thing. There is still a chance this case could be solved for Sheila's living relatives and for Sheila herself. I really hope it will be. As always, contact details to the relevant authorities will be in the description box down below. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.